Hare Krishna.
Okay.
I'm going to read from Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, chapter 4, text 38. Here's the original Sanskrit verse spoken by Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Nahi gyanena sadrisham pavitram iha vidyate tad swayam yoga sangsidha kalena atmani vindati. The translation: in this world there is nothing so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge. Such knowledge is the mature fruit of all mysticism. And one who has become accomplished in the practice of devotional service enjoys this knowledge within himself in due course of time. Purport. In other words, the explanation of this verse is given as follows. When we speak of transcendental knowledge, we do so in terms of spiritual understanding. As such, there is nothing so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge. Ignorance is the cause of our bondage, and knowledge is the cause of our liberation. This knowledge is the mature fruit of devotional service, and when one is situated in transcendental knowledge, he need not search for peace elsewhere, for he enjoys peace within himself. In other words, this knowledge and peace culminate in Krishna consciousness. That is the last word in the Bhagavad Gita. Here in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says, ignorance is the cause of our bondage and knowledge is the cause of our liberation. This is a very important understanding, point to understand. We are bound in this material world. We're tied up. You're tied up, you feel tied up. Ireland's a free country. Just check it. Ireland's a free country. Who's free? Anyone here free from birth and death? Here, freedom means freedom from birth and death. But most people don't even know that what their real problem is. Their problem is paying the bills. That's the main problem. If we ask people, what are their problems? Most people say paying the bills, backache, or whatever ache, some health problem. This is due to ignorance. Socrates is said to have stated, the only good is knowledge and the only evil is ignorance. So what does this mean? What do we mean when we say knowledge? Dublin, among its many glories, is a place of knowledge, right? It's a place of learning. What is it, Trinity College, and what's the other? UCD, University College of Dublin, yeah. Hundreds of years old, cultivating knowledge. And no one ever came out of UCD or Trinity College and got free from birth and death. There's knowledge about this world. Knowledge, for instance, how to get a Fender amplifier to work. That's one kind of knowledge. There are all kinds of knowledge, pragmatic knowledge. To live in the world these days, we need a lot of knowledge. Sometimes we hear people say, we want to be more natural. Well, if you want to be completely natural, we can run around in the jungle. You don't need much knowledge to do that, right? Run around in the jungle and hunt some pigs. But there are no jungles left in Ireland. There must have been jungles at some point. Forests. Here they call them forests. Jungle gives the idea of something in a warmer climate. They wouldn't allow you anyway. You'd be stuck in prison if you ran around half naked with bows and arrows. Even that's some knowledge, right? That's a little more. That's some technology, bows and arrows. Crude technology. So if you want to be really natural, then you could do that. We can say that the advancement of civilization is advancement of knowledge, isn't it? The more what they call civilization means more knowledge. There's a major problem with all of this, though, that all this knowledge that's amassed in civilization, it doesn't make us happy here, right now, in this world. It doesn't seem to make us very civilized, if you take civilized to mean civil behavior. And certainly doesn't free us from birth and death, because at least in the Western world, the whole civilization is running for practically since the beginning on a great misconception, massive misunderstanding, that this life is the only life. You're born and you die, then it's all finished. They don't. In other words, they don't know that we are eternal living beings and that we go from one body to another. So, in other words, we can say that this is, for all its amassment of knowledge, this whole civilization is based on ignorance. Here in the Bhagavad Gita, we'll find this term, jnana, comes up many times, as it comes up in this verse. anyone who speaks an Indian language, they know the word jnana. It's a very common word in every Indian language up to the present day. Maybe not in Urdu or Tamil or some northeastern languages, but in the main or most of the languages derived from Sanskrit, they all use the word jnana. It means knowledge. It's simply translated as knowledge. And that means all kinds of knowledge. Even how to get a Fender amplifier to work, that's one kind of knowledge. That would technically fall into the category of yantra vidya, or technology, or knowledge of machines. But here in Bhagavad Gita, and generally in spiritual discussions, the term jnana does not refer to pragmatic knowledge of this world, which is needed also. If we're to go beyond hunting in the forest, even for that you have to know how to make a bow and arrow, how to use it. Some knowledge is required. Even if you kill a pig in the forest, how to cook it, how to have a fire. Some kind of knowledge is required. Even the ants have knowledge. They don't go to school or university. They have knowledge of engineering at their own level. So some kind of pragmatic knowledge is required in this world, and we're glad it's there. Just like if you have a toothache, is it a question of if? Everyone's had a toothache, right? Anyone had a toothache? Anasuya, ever had a toothache? You have, all right. So it starts young, and it's not very pleasant. What about Dhruv? Not yet, don't worry. You will also have, don't worry, you may worry. Everyone gets toothaches, and it's unpleasant. So we're glad there are people who go to school, college, university, and study for so many years, so they know what to do when you have a toothache. We're glad that there is such knowledge in human society. But in Bhagavad Gita, the term knowledge means the kind of knowledge so that we won't ever get toothaches ever again. What kind of knowledge is that? To put all the dentists out of business. Well, you won't get a toothache again, you won't have tax problems, you won't have family problems, you won't have divorce problems, you won't have any problems. That's real knowledge, is to get free from all problems, which means to get free from birth and death. That is the real knowledge, which means to understand why are we suffering in the first place? The beginning of knowledge in any sphere is to recognize there is a problem and then to address it. Just like someone somewhere or people in different places, they thought, well, we would like to make a facility whereby sound can be amplified. There's some problem, you can say, some issue, that if we had amplification, then we could address crowds of 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 all at one time. So they developed this sound amplification system. There was a problem or a lacking, a deficiency, and it was addressed by developing this sound amplification system. Similarly, lighting, there's a problem, it gets dark and we can't see very well. And that was solved to some extent by lamps, fire. What was the fuel used here in Ireland? Anyone know before the advent of electric lights? Kerosene, probably. And before that? Pitch. Peat. You have you had a little peat and you burn that in a little holder. No, I'm talking about a little lamp for, see. Castor oil, maybe? Paraffin, yeah, but before that would have been probably. Castor oil, maybe? Grow castor plants here in Ireland. See, it would have been universal at one point. Now it's completely forgotten. Now we can't even imagine. Anyway, someone, somewhere, has developed electric lights, and they're very well designed. They're planned obsolescence, so that they'll break after some time. You have to buy a new one. Although many years ago it was invented, the kind of light that wouldn't ever need replacing. But then Philips in Eindhoven wouldn't have any business, so they make it very expertly. They only last for some time. So there's a problem, and it's addressed by knowledge, by finding out what is to be done. This is how knowledge is developed. But if one looks and sees that the whole world is just one big row of problems, one after the other, and it's severe suffering. Toothache is severe suffering, right? It's only a little tooth. Once it's pulled out, it doesn't look very spectacular. Even when it's in the mouth, it doesn't look very spectacular. Just a little tooth. But can really be painful. Very, very painful. If you don't treat it, if you decide I'll just sit it out, then you can't sleep. It can be so painful. So toothache's not there. That's just one. There's a whole cycle of repeated birth and death. So someone who's intelligent thinks, well, how can we get free from this? So this knowledge of how to be free from birth and death, that is the knowledge given in Bhagavad Gita. That is the most important knowledge. There's so much knowledge available in human society at the present time via the internet. What is the, Spanish word for? You say God, someone may know. Maybe something like Dios, something like that. From Latin? Dios. Yeah. Okay, let's say. What's the Spanish word for dog? Oh, we have a Spanish-speaking person here. Okay, what's the Czech word for... What's the Czech word for God? Bog, it would be, I think. Same as Russian. For dog? Look it up. You don't have to look it up. But if you want, you can find it on the internet. That's the point I make. You can get anything you want on the internet. Anyone want hamburgers? I hope not. You can just order it right now and someone will bring it. Is it? Probably. Yeah. If you're in the wilds of Mayo, maybe not. But in Dublin, you can just get it from the internet. You can get all kinds of knowledge from the internet. But that is knowledge of this world. How to get free from birth and death. That is the topic which is addressed in Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita starts off with Arjuna's contemplation of massive death. He's about to go into a battle in which he is expected to kill literally thousands, if not hundreds, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. He doesn't have a problem with that per se, because he's done it before. He's trained to do that. He's not a heartless killer, but he knows that he has to do that sometimes. He may have to do that. But in this particular instance, he didn't want to, because he was ready to fight for the sake of dharma. Dharma is loosely translated as religion, or the harmonizing principle in the universe, or the harmony of the universe. So there are people who act so badly in the world that it's better for the world that they are dead rather than alive. That is the principle of Kshatriya Dharma, the warrior's duty. So Arjuna was comfortable with that, and he was prepared to do that. But the only problem is that we have to see what is dharma. When is it proper to kill someone? In the modern age, there's a lot of propaganda. There should be no capital punishment and no wars. You can say no wars, and just ahimsa, non-violence. But if you have non-violence, then someone will come and take advantage. As I often say, in India, where I've spent most of this life, if the Indian government was to declare a fully Gandhian policy of non-violence, with no violence, then within the amount of time it would take to travel from Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan, to Delhi, then the whole of India, it would be under Pakistan. That's all. They'd take over, because you require the Indian army if you want India to be not ruled by Pakistan, to keep out the Pakistani army. So that's just realistic, that's all. If the police go on strike, Garda, isn't it in Ireland they're called? If they go on strike, then immediately there'll be looting that happened in New Orleans after the Katrina. Immediately there was looting, because there was no police to guard the situation. Someone sent me a clip for a video for one of the, I think it was last year, there was a hurricane about to hit Florida. You weren't there. You were there? And one of the people interviewed, he spoke about the, in this kind of situation, then he referred to the thin veneer of civilization, that in a situation like that, it can break down. In other words, people, what does that mean? There's a thin veneer of civilization. People are kept civilized by the police. What's the greatest contributing factor to civilization in Dublin today? The police. Because if they're not there, then people will just be like ferocious animals. So violence, or the threat thereof, is required in human society. Unless people are all saints. And we're not anywhere close to that. So that is required. And Arjuna, he lived in the world in a time of particular social turbulence. So he'd already killed many people. And he didn't have a problem with that, because he understood that it was his duty to do so. A lot of people have problem with that when we say this. But in this particular instance, Arjuna had a big problem, because he thought, no, this fight which I'm about to engage in, that will not improve the situation of the world. That will make it worse. The Second World War, at least ostensibly, was fought to stop the Nazis. It would have been worse if the Nazis had taken over all of Europe. So that was considered a just war. In Christianity, Saint Augustine brought in the concept of a just war. So most people up to the present day consider, yeah, it was good. It was good that the Allies fought off the Nazis. So it's something like that. Arjuna was ready to fight a just war, but not so many people are convinced that the NATO troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria are there for the point of justice. It seems to be something more to do with oil, gas, and geopolitics. Is it a just war? Maybe not. So Arjuna, he was in a situation where he had a big problem. He thought to fight the upcoming battle is not going to be proper. And Krishna, the whole of Bhagavad Gita is Krishna convincing Arjuna that, first of all, he should fight in this situation. He'd misunderstood the situation. And that, anyway, this whole material existence is full of problems. You can't avoid problems. But an intelligent person should attempt to get the knowledge whereby we can be free of all problems eternally. So some knowledge is required about that. Now, of course, there are atheists who say that anyway, when you die, you're finished. So no need to worry about all of this. How would you answer that? When you die, you're finished. What's the answer? Well, one way to answer that is to pose another question. Who are you? Who are you that is finished? If you say you're finished, it means what? The body doesn't walk or talk or eat or have any desires or any activity. But mostly people think, I am the body. Just like we met a group of young men, presumably from India, and they said to me, Kaise, how are you? And I said to them, well, first you should understand, who are you? That's the first thing. Aap kaun hai, I said. And one said my name, Nitesh Jain, and someone said something else. This is my name. So in other words, they identified with the body. So if we say, when you die, what dies? The body dies. But what is the factor in the body that makes it alive? Because before death and after death, it's a bag of chemicals, right? What chemicals? What are the main chemicals in the body? I guess water must be. Hydrogen, oxygen, carbon. There's a lot of carbon in there. If you walk around Dublin, you probably get a bit of lead here and there. Sulfur, so many sulfur, nitrogen, potassium, zinc, and gold, a little bit of gold in there. So we're going to go and kill you and extract the gold. So we're told there's a little bit of gold in there. There are all kinds of chemicals in there. A lot of nitrogen also, did I say that? Okay. So that's the first question. Are you chemicals? If you say, when you die, everything's finished. But the chemicals aren't finished. It's just death means there's a different formation. That mostly the chemicals stay the same, but they react in a different way. So the chemicals are always going on reacting, even when you're alive. So if you say that when you die, you're finished. Then what's the difference between being alive and being dead? What is the difference? What is the difference? It's just the chemicals work in a certain way when you're alive and they work in a different way when you're dead. What's the difference?
The soul.
The soul, yeah. Well, what makes you, when you're hungry, you want to eat something, right? Where does that desire come from? You could say that, well, it's this, some chemical in some part of the brain active is inspired by some nerves from the stomach. I don't know, maybe there's some neurophysiologist here who could tell us to send some message that you need some food. But where does the desire come from? Just like, to give a very simple example, okay, you can say, well, I see a red light. If you shine a red light here, I could say, I see a red light, right? I see a red light. I could say that and communicate that to you. You could also make a machine with a sensor that if a red light is shone in front of it, it says, I see a red light in machine talk. Does the machine see a red light? Does it have the experience of seeing? No. But I have the experience of seeing. So what's the difference between me and the machine? The conscious principle is a big question among psychologists and neuroscientists and philosophers. What is consciousness? What is it that experiences? It's not chemicals. Chemicals don't have any, they don't experience anything. So the answer is that it is the soul, which is a different energy to the body. When the soul leaves the body, we say dead. But the body by its nature is anyway dead. There's no inherent life in the carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and so on that makes up the body. It's the soul that gives life. And when the soul leaves, then there's no more desire, there's no more hunger, there's no more love, there's no more hate, there's no more Nitesh Jain. Rest in peace, R.I.P. Swaga Prabd, he went to heaven. They may write in the paper. Where he went, we don't know. They hope he went to heaven. So it's the soul. The knowledge, Bhagavad Gita's knowledge of the soul. Krishna teaches Arjuna that as long as we remain in this world, we're going to have all kinds of problems. We have to go to the spiritual world. We have to have knowledge of the spiritual world, our position there. Why are we in this material world? Because of material desire. This is all explained in Bhagavad Gita. This is jnana. This is knowledge. So it's not knowledge here. It doesn't just mean amassing information and learning how to use it in a manner that we can exist in this world in a more sophisticated manner than people running around with bows and arrows shooting pigs. That's not knowledge in the highest sense. That is one kind of knowledge. But here in Bhagavad Gita, knowledge means knowledge of, first of all, who we are. Why are we in this situation? Understanding that this situation is not a very good situation. It's not the proper situation. We're not meant to die. We don't want to die. We're not meant to die, but because we identify with the body, we think that we die. But actually, as the soul continues to live, and then we get another body, and according to what we did in previous life, then we have to enjoy or suffer in future life. So atheists, they just say that, well, when you're dead, everything is finished. There's no soul. Although they say, well, you can't show the soul, you can't prove the soul. Well, that's true in terms of if we take their limiting idea of what knowledge is, because according to the empiric, supposedly scientific outlook, Knowledge is only that which we can touch, taste, smell, feel, hear, which we can experience through our senses, and we can, on the basis of that, we can extrapolate various kinds of knowledge. Getting back to Socrates, every man is mortal. Can you prove it? Every man is mortal. Well, you're alive, you didn't die yet. That body didn't die yet, so you never know, you might live forever. It's unprovable, but it's taken as an axiom. It's just presumed on the basis that, well, my mother died. Maybe some of your mothers have died. If not, your grandmothers, grandparents. And we see everyone dies, so we just presume that every man is mortal. Every man and every person is mortal, we have to say nowadays. Not just men. Every man, woman, and transgender, and they're all, whatever it is, they're all mortal. There's all this talk about transgender and gay and queer. And, hey, look, we're going to die. And why make such a big thing about this sexual issues? We're all going to die. What happens after that? That we should think about. That is knowledge. That is the beginning of knowledge, to think about not what's going on in your genitals, but what's going on beyond birth and death. So atheists, they say that, well, we don't accept there's any soul. But even scientifically considered, there is tremendous reason to believe that we are born again and again and again. There's so much evidence of reincarnation. But people who believe in atheism, they won't accept it. They've got no good reason, even scientifically speaking, not to accept it, but they don't want to, because they're human beings and they have biases like everyone else. So they don't like to accept that there is birth and death. In other words, spiritual knowledge is required. Spiritual knowledge, well, where will we get that from? Well, that knowledge has to come from beyond the material platform. We like to talk about science and scientific knowledge and proven knowledge. But human beings, apart from being mortal, there are some other problems with being a human being also. Not just being mortal. Well, there are the problems of that we have to suffer birth, death, old age, and disease. That's included in mortality. But also in our endeavors to get knowledge, we have the tendency to make mistakes, to be an illusion. To make a mistake is one thing, and to presume something which is wrong to be right is an illusion. We have imperfect senses. For instance, we can't see. You're looking this way, I'm looking that way. You can both see a wall. What's beyond the wall? We can't see. Imperfect senses. And we also have a tendency to cheat others, and even to cheat ourselves, and to presume that, or to project that we know things which we don't actually know. So these are problems in the material condition, why we can't get knowledge, why we can't get spiritual knowledge just by ourselves, because of these defects that we have. So here in Bhagavad Gita, knowledge, it doesn't mean amassment of information, but it means knowledge of the most important thing, who we are, why we are suffering in this world, how we can go beyond suffering. For some people, listening to this talk is suffering. It's too boring or whatever, and they don't like to stay. That's because there are more interesting things to do. If we take our platform of pleasure to be the interaction of the senses with the sense objects. And they think, oh, it's a religious talk. It's not religious so far. Did I say anything religious? You might take it like that, but it's philosophy. It's just trying to understand with our intelligence. But there are limits to that also. Bhagavad Gita teaches not that knowledge is not just amassment of information, but understanding. To have a proper understanding of who we are, where we're going, where we need to go. So who will say what is a proper understanding? Then we come to religion. Christians will say, well, you have to follow the Bible. Muslims will say you have to follow the Quran. It's scripture. It's revealed by God. I had a problem with that in my childhood because Christians, okay, they believe in the Bible, but then why are they killing each other? Same with Muslims. It doesn't seem to give them very advanced spiritual knowledge. And also, major problem in these religious systems is the idea of a God who chucks you into hell forever without any chance of redemption. That was a problem for me, and probably it is for many others also. And the understanding of reincarnation is proper understanding. We are mistake-prone beings. If we make a mistake and choose the wrong religion or get born in the wrong religion, then we get burned in hell forever. That doesn't sound like a very good God who does that to you. But reincarnation gives us the understanding that God gives us many chances to work things out, to find out what's actually going on. Of course, Buddhists also accept reincarnation. But they can't explain it because they don't believe in the soul. It's very difficult to understand who or what reincarnates. And also, yeah, I'm talking about now getting knowledge from a higher source. So I'm just very briefly pointing out some of the inadequacies of the Bible and the Quran, and then we come to Buddhism. But they also have their scriptures. Well, not really. If we take scripture as knowledge revealed from a higher source, there's no canonical scriptures in Buddhism. And if we are to take what the Buddha himself is said to have said, then we shouldn't even accept him as an authority. It's really got to come from yourself. But then they have so many books. But then who wrote the books? If it's not a perfect person, then it's not fully competent to help us. But according to their philosophy, when you become perfect, then you cease to exist. And they have the idea of the Bodhisattva who comes back again and again. Why he should do so? Strange idea they have, that there's reincarnation, but there's no person who reincarnates because people don't exist and nothing exists. And nothing not exists also. You get involved in logical convolutions. So if we are to have knowledge beyond the platform of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, which is basically what all of human civilization is doing in a sophisticated way, which the animals also do. If we're going to have knowledge beyond the human frailties of being mistake-prone, being illusion-prone, having imperfect senses, and the tendency to cheat others and ourselves, then we have to take we have to have faith that there is such knowledge. Some faith is required also to go beyond the platform of skepticism, to go beyond the limiting, to beyond the limits of our very constrained experience and intelligence. We have to accept that there is a higher source of knowledge. That knowledge is given herein in the Bhagavad Gita by Lord Krishna, who all the great advanced spiritualists of Vedic culture, Veda means knowledge, they all accept Krishna as the dispenser of the highest knowledge. Even Shankaracharya refers to Krishna as Jagat Guru, the proper instructor for the whole universe. And here in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, Jnanam teham savijnanam midang vakshyami sheshataha yad gyatva nehabhuyo yad gyatavyam avasishyate. Krishna says to Arjuna, I will now give you the full knowledge, both of this world and spiritual knowledge. I will now tell you in full all about that, by knowing which you won't need to know anything else. So when Krishna says, I'll give you knowledge in full, does he give the knowledge by which we can understand how many seagulls are in Dublin right now? That's one kind of knowledge, right? I think you could only estimate it, because it'd be very difficult to say exactly. So that would be one kind of knowledge. Yeah, but that's not the knowledge Krishna's talking about. When Krishna says, I give full material knowledge, it doesn't mean of every fact that's possible to ascertain in the world. There are unlimited facts. How many amoeba are swimming around in your gut at the present time? Well, even if you know, it doesn't help you much, does it? Some things might help, just like what's the address of the local dentist when you get a toothache. That would help. But that doesn't help in the fullest sense. When Krishna gives knowledge of the material world, he gives knowledge of what is the nature of this world. It's full of suffering. How we can get out of this material world and ascend to the spiritual platform. So that is the knowledge that Krishna is giving. And that's the real knowledge that we need to acquire in this human life. It's very short. In a few days, it'll all be over. Maybe less than a few days. We can never tell. We can never tell what will happen, even in 1 second from now. Anything can happen, anytime, anywhere. But one thing we can know, whether it's today, tomorrow, after 20 years, after 50 years, we're all going to leave this body. We're all going to die. So we should live in such a way that we don't get born again. Ladva sudurlabha midang bahusambhavante manusham artadama nityam api hadhira turnam yatedana patedana mrityayava nishrayasaya vishaya kalu sarvatasyat. This is very important instruction given by Lord Krishna, that we have many, 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 many births. How many births have we been through? Can't say. Now we have a human birth. It's very rarely attained. Very rarely attained. There are so many species of life and so many living beings. So we rotate in this species of life, 8,400,000 species of life. Human life is rarely attained. There are how many humans are there supposed to be on the planet at the present time? Approximately 8 something billion, is it? 8 billion approximately, but that's nothing compared to, there are probably more mosquitoes in North India alone, must be, definitely. Definitely in the cities there are more mosquitoes than humans, especially at this season it will be. Hot and wet, paradise for a mosquito. So that's mosquito, and then the blades of grass, even every blade of grass as a soul. Otherwise, how can it grow? How can it have experience? even the grass experiences. The grass even has, the living being in the form of a grass has desire also. Otherwise, why does the plant grow toward the light? In a very limited way, it expresses consciousness. So the human form of life is very rare, Lord Krishna says. But whoever can understand this instruction, whichever living beings can understand this instruction, means they are in a human body. Because even the chimpanzees and the dogs, who are supposed to be more intelligent than the caterpillars, their intelligence is not up to the level where they can understand the very point that we are in a body that's going to die and we get body after body. So having got this human life, Krishna says, we should act in such a way that we're not going to die again, not get born again. That is this special facility in the human life form. Therefore, we should be very intelligent and act in a manner that we don't get born again. And if we think, well, why not just enjoy ourselves? There are so many things to enjoy. And Lord Krishna tells us that, yeah, that's true, but you've enjoyed in so many lifetimes. And you can go on enjoying, but what's the enjoyment? Where's the happiness? Where's the happiness? Just like many of you have come from India, I presume. And you thought you'd find happiness in Dublin. Well, you got some money, right? But did you get happiness? That's something else. Money equals happiness is, you get a tick or a cross for that. What's the answer? Generally, people think money equals happiness. And if you don't have any money, well, it can be pretty rough. But after a certain amount, it doesn't increase your happiness and probably increases your anxieties also. So money does not equal happiness. So if we think we want to enjoy this world, that's a mistake. That's going on in every species of life. Every living being is trying to enjoy themselves via the senses. But knowledge begins with understanding that our existence is not, our real existence is not on the platform of the bodily senses, but it's on the spiritual platform. So Lord Krishna is teaching that in a general way in the scriptures that gives knowledge. This Bhagavad Gita especially is the introduction to spiritual knowledge. To understand it in detail, tad vijnanartham sagurum eva abhigacchet. To understand this in detail, we have to approach a guru, someone who is in knowledge of all these factors, all these matters, who can instruct us. And what will he teach? Will teach us that we are eternal, spiritual beings. We are not meant for suffering in this world. Our eternal, happy position. We are meant for happiness, eternal, bliss, not just happiness, bliss. We are meant for a blissful life in the eternal, loving service of Krishna, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There is a process to become free from the bondage of this material world. What is the bondage? Why do we get born again and again? Because we have material desires to fulfill. As long as we have material desires to fulfill, we will get material bodies to attempt to fulfill them. So we have to become free from material desire. That is possible by cultivating spiritual desire, which means the desire to serve Krishna, who's completely spiritual. And when our consciousness is completely purified, then we can go beyond this world of birth and death. So this is the knowledge that is given in Bhagavad Gita. This is the best knowledge. This is ultimately the only really important knowledge. Knowledge of dentistry and of sound amplification and this kind of knowledge is important to the extent that living in this world is important. But living in this world is only important as long as we understand that it's not really important at all. That the importance, the excessive importance that we give to it, give to living in this world, is the cause of our being born again and again, suffering again and again in this world. So this knowledge of Bhagavad Gita is the best knowledge. It's the only real knowledge which everyone needs to learn. We should change all the courses in Trinity College and UCD and make it all Krishna conscious. And someone still has to learn dentistry. But it does help to know you're not the body. Once I was at a dentist and getting some drilling, and the dentist decided to do it without anesthetic. I guess he wanted to test me to see if I was self-realized. It was extremely painful. Or maybe he just gave very light anesthetic, which wore off very quickly. But anyway, whatever, it was extremely painful. And he told me afterwards, and I was still, I mean, when he stopped drilling, the pain didn't stop. It took quite some time to go away. But he said that, well, at first when I started drilling, I could see that you were very tense. Then I saw that you were relaxed. And I said, yeah, that in the beginning it was very painful. It went on being painful, but then I just thought, I'm not this body. And it did help. It does help to overcome. So the pain is real, but it's temporary. Going beyond pain, that is real knowledge, to find out how to do that, to come to the bliss, platform of bliss beyond birth and death. Hare Krishna. So I'll finish this short talk here. Does anyone have any question, please? Yes, please. Is the need to pay the bills a desire? Probably not. You probably don't want to pay the bills, do you? Yeah. But it's all based on desire, because you're in a situation, right? I don't want to pay the bill, but I don't want to be thrown out of the house and thrown in prison. So I have to choose between paying the bill and ending up in the clink. In other words, clink, it's British slang for, English slang for prison. I don't know if it's used in Ireland also. Hmm? It is, yeah. And they take you in the paddy wagon, right? Why do they call it the paddy wagon? They used to throw the paddies in more. There's general perception in England that every Irishman is a criminal. So anyway, let's get back to some proper understanding here. So it's the best of two evils. Yeah, it's desire. But underlying all of this is the desire to live in this material world happily. So it's all based on desire. There are levels of desire. If you don't pay the bills, you can't even do the devotional work. That's right. That's why I said it's good to have a dentist, and that's just an example. But there's all kinds of knowledge, but which is required to live in this world. But the point is, we should live in such a way. What is that? Kamasya nendriya priti yavan. What is the verse? Yavan. I can't forget it. Hmm.
Kamasya nendriya priti.
Yeah. Labho jiveta yavata jivasya tatva jigyasa narto yascheha karma bihi. One should live in this world with the first word in this verse, and is karma. Karma means desire. So one should live in this world with the desire, jivasya tatva jigyasa, to inquire into the nature of life. That should be the goal of one's work. So one's desire should be focused on that. And as a necessity, we need to eat, sleep, and for that we need food, clothing, shelter. modern civilization has made it very, very complicated. So it's the necessities of life are food, clothing, shelter. These are the basic necessities of the body. But now it's necessity to have a cell phone, and probably, is it a law in Ireland, you have to have some number? Everyone has a number? No, you don't have that. Registration card and all this. They're doing that in India now, right? The Aadhaar card. Everyone has to have a number. So it's a necessity. You can't do anything without that number, because you can't do anything connected with the government. So, it's a very unnecessarily complicated society in which all the time and attention and energy of people just goes in working so they can get money to pay the bills. But then what's the purpose of life? And the purpose of life is to go out on Friday and Saturday and get drunk. For most people, that seems to be about it, isn't it? And you get married and have some kids, and then they also get born and they also pay the bills. Is there something more than that? That we should think. How do you get rid of this desire? Well, there's the idea of getting free from desire. But as we are living beings, remember, we're different from the chemicals. What's the difference between a living being and chemicals? Desire is one, or consciousness. And with consciousness comes desire. So if we don't have desire, then we're not conscious. So it's not possible. We are eternal. By nature, we have desire. But the desire to enjoy this world causes us to suffer in this world. So Bhagavad Gita teaches us to develop those desires by which we can live in the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, the desire is centered on Krishna, the supreme loving person. And desires translate into love for Krishna. Serving Krishna. Here in this material world, what goes on the name of love, it's mixed up with material desire. It's all on the platform of material desire. Just like, for instance, young men fall in love with young women, not with 90-year-old women. The 90-year-old woman is quite likely a better person in many ways than the 20-year-old woman. So why do you fall in love? It's the body, attraction to the body. In this material world, what goes on in the name of love, a lot of it is sexual and animalistic. So real love means on the spiritual platform, where we don't want to enjoy ourselves, we just simply want to serve Krishna, and Krishna is so loving that he reciprocates in such a way that we feel fully satisfied. There's no exploitation. In this material world, love means exploitation. Everything, the whole of human interaction is one person is trying to get something from someone else. The land of exploitation. Anyone else? Yes, please. Prior to 554 AD. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's said that in Christianity they used to believe in reincarnation. Although that is disputed. Yeah. Yeah, the conference in Constantinople, which threw it out. But that narrative is disputed nowadays, like pretty much everything else in ancient history. There was, in early Christianity, there was widespread belief in reincarnation. There were the Gnostics who believed in reincarnation, and it got thrown out, it seems. The origins of Christianity and the Bible are murky, not very clear. There are indications from the what's recorded in the words of Jesus that he understood about reincarnation. As they sow, so they shall reap. Doesn't necessarily point to karma, but it seems to do. Talking about Saint John, some say that he is Elijah come again, Saint John the Baptist. So if he's Elijah come again, then that's reincarnation, isn't it? So there are indications that Jesus was aware of this, and we would think so because he was clearly a spiritually advanced person. But according to some sources, it was accepted Christian doctrine and it got thrown out. But then others dispute that. So it's not so safe to say that. It's disputed. But anyway, whether they say it or not, it's a fact. So it doesn't make that much difference. It's unfortunate that there's such a big culture and a big religion, and they don't know the ABCs of spiritual knowledge. Anything else? He said it was done for political reasons, and because the wife of the emperor didn't like it. But we don't know for sure. Who knows what happened so long ago? It's difficult to say. Even if you read the newspaper today, you can't be sure whether it's true or not. So what to speak about 1600 years ago? Shankaracharya says Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya. Spiritual is true and this world is false.
Yes. So how does the Vaishnava philosophy understand this statement?
How does the Vaishnava philosophy understand this statement? Brahma is Satya. God is real. This world is in one sense real and another sense false. It's likened to a dream. Is a dream real? In a dream you see yourself flying in the sky with wings and you wake up and you realize that's not true. But there was a dream. So in one sense the dream is real, isn't it? If you can talk about a dream, it means that it had some existence. Real means it has existence. But it's a false concept of existence. So this whole material existence, it's real in the sense that just like in a dream, you can experience pain and pleasure. So we experience pain and pleasure, but it's not our real existence. So it's both true and it's both real and false. But even if we say it's real, it's not the real reality. Just like a dream is not real reality in comparison. The night dream is not real in comparison to the apparent reality of this extended daydream that we have. But it just lasts one lifetime. And then we go into another phase of dream. It's just that you have one dream, you wake up and you think, oh, that wasn't real. So we're in one body and we think it's real. And then we end that body and we get another body and we think that's real. So it's just like going from one dream to another. When we wake up, we go to the spiritual world with Krishna. And then there's no more dreaming, no more changing bodies. Just one thing I came across yesterday or the day before. Just how a little change of perspective can have such a big difference. Because Shankaracharya says that the Atma is consciousness. The Atma, the soul that's spoken of in Bhagavad Gita and in the Upanishads. Actually, we don't in the Gita we don't find the term Atma used very much as it's used in the Upanishads. We have the word dehi, shariri, and so on. Not so much. But he takes the Atma to be consciousness. Whereas the Vaishnavas say that the Atma is the seat of consciousness, or the conscious. So it's just a little change. It seems to be a little change of perspective, but it makes a tremendous difference, because you say the Atma is consciousness. Well, consciousness is theoretically, by consciousness, we can go anywhere. We can understand anything in all phases of time. So if we say we are consciousness, and then when we stop getting reborn, we become just consciousness. That means we become omniscient and we become God, which is his idea. But if we say that the Atma is the seat of consciousness, that means we are individual, localized points, foci of consciousness. And there is the supreme consciousness, Vedaham Samatitani Vartamanani Charjana Bhavishyani Chabuta, who knows everything in all phases of time. That is Krishna. So there's the supreme consciousness and individual consciousness. So if we say, I am consciousness, in one sense, it's correct. But a more precise is that I am conscious. It's just like the sun and the sunshine. The sun and the sunshine eternally exist, well, as long as the sun exists. But from our short perspective of this lifetime, it seems we can say it's always existing. They always exist, but still the sunshine is dependent on the sun. So consciousness is always present with the soul. So in one sense, they're non-different. They're inseparable. Inseparable. But at the same time, the Atma is the source of consciousness. This is a very important word to understand. Recently, I was giving a talk in Hindi and discussing this very point, and we're trying to find a word for inseparable. But in the dictionary, in the internet dictionary, there wasn't a suitable word, didn't come up. They found abheda, which means non-different, but it's not the same. It's not exactly the same. Abheda, abhinna. And eventually someone came up with the term aviyoja, which no one ever heard in Hindi. Maybe some Sanskrit people heard. But that's actually inseparable. But that's a very important word. It's different to non-different. Non-different means there's no difference whatsoever, but inseparable means that they're together, but they're not the same. The very word inseparable gives the understanding that they are different, but they're together all the time. So in one sense, you could say they are the same, because just like you may say that John and Jill are inseparable. Why? You always see them together. It doesn't last long, but anyway, John and Jill are inseparable because you always see them together. So if you say, is John here? It's the same as saying, is Jill here? Because it's understood. They're inseparable. But they're not the same. John is not Jill. And Jill is not John. So these it's very important points to understand, because there are many people who say that, you see, it's all one and we're all the same. Okay, so when you're hungry, you can come sit down at the table, and I'll sit down at the table and I'll put a big meal in front of me and I'll eat it. And you can watch me, because it's all the same. Is it? You'll remain hungry. And you'll maybe get angry. Why is he eating and not giving me anything? Oh, it's all the same. So the money in your pocket, well, it might as well be in my pocket, because it's all the same. So you can say like that, but it's not true. There are many problems with this idea. We're all the same. It's all one. Everything is just love. These are maybe nice sounding words, but they have even a little investigation or consider, even if we don't have to go as far as investigate, just little think about it a little bit, we can understand that it has no actual meaning. What do you think, Anusuya? Is sitting there listening very attentively. Hare Krishna. Anything else?
And I kind of found out that literally everyone around me is a demon, including my husband, including myself. And it's a hard knowledge to take, you know? You know, he's talking about surahs and asuras.
Yeah, the demoniac nature is described in Bhagavad Gita's 16th chapter. In the beginning of that chapter, Krishna summarizes that dambo darpa vimanascha krodha parisham evacha agyana chabidatas ya partha sambadam asurim. The basic nature of the demons, this is how Srila Prabhupada translates the word asura, the basic nature is pride, arrogance, conceit, harsh speech, ignorance. Here, ignorance means ignorance of the purpose of life, what I've been talking about in this talk. And Krishna goes on to explain in more detail. So you found out that pretty much everyone around you, including your husband, including yourself, is like that. Well, that's typical of Kali Yuga. In Kali Yuga, we're all... This is the age of quarrel and hypocrisy. And generally, people get born in this age who have mostly got the bad qualities. In other ages, people have better qualities, but not in this age. The great thing in this age is that Krishna has come as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and give us the purifying process of chanting the holy names of Krishna, by which we can get free from these demoniac propensities. But it's not that everyone's a complete demon. It's mixed bag. You wouldn't be sitting here listening if you were a total fiend, would you?
It's kind of hard to take, you know, kind of think, okay, demon, okay, Ravan, he's a demon, he's a bad guy. You know, Yakshakur, Hiranyakashipu, a bad guy, he's a demon, but that's one thing. But when you kind of learn that, you know...
Yeah, no, it's not just Ravana, Hiranyakashipu, it's the sweet old lady next door. Sweet old lady next door who's playing computer games to annihilate or whatever. Yeah. Well, that's what these kids are going to do when they're grandparents, right? It's whatever you learn in your childhood, if they ever make it to grandmotherliness after they've had their sex change operation and shot themselves up with so many drugs that they die at the age of 20. So, is it true or not? People are living exploitively. People cooperate with each other in society as a survival necessity. Just like, for instance, as is well known, giving the example of Nazi Germany again, that most of the ordinary, nice, good people of Nazi Germany came to support the Nazis, and they would engage in rounding up and killing Jews and others. What happened to them being nice, good, decent people? More recently, in what was Yugoslavia, Croatians and Serbians and Bosnian Muslims, and they were all doing horrible things to each other. Even someone to his own wife. A Serbian man had married a Croatian wife, and all of a sudden, he kills her. Why? A demoniac propensity had been awakened by propaganda. So the propaganda in modern society makes us demoniac, actually. This demoniac propensity means an increase of kam, krodh, and lobha, which means lust, greed, and anger, which gives rise to envy and so many bad qualities. But that's promoted for instance, in the TV, which is a major cultural factor, which you were just telling me, on the East Coast here, you get the English TV, East Coast of Ireland. So the television is meant for increasing our material desires and our greed. And what is it? There's a lot of sex, either gross or subtle. The message that to get lots of money is that's what life's all about. Advertisements, buy this, buy that. The whole consumer society would just collapse if what they call the advertising industry. I don't know if it's an industry, it's supposed to produce something, but they just produce desires in people's mind by selling them products which they don't need and they don't want, but they make a desire. And then people buy it, and people don't. They say people are intelligent. I don't think so. Otherwise, why do people smoke? Why do they drink Coca-Cola? Why do they drink coffee? Doesn't do me any good, but just because of advertising. So the whole society is pumping up the lust, greed, anger, envy, illusion. Then you become demoniac, and especially you get more and more desires. I want, I want, I want. And then to hell with you. That's what happens. The whole society becomes demoniac. So becoming godly means becoming free of material desire. So it may be hard to accept, but there may be many more things which are hard to accept, because after all, we've been living in this illusion of I am this body, life after life, since time immemorial. Therefore, we have to take actual knowledge of the situation of this material world. Why are we born again and again and again? Because of material desire. The more we have material desire, the more we are ungodly. If you want to use that sounds euphemistic compared to demoniac. Anything else? Yeah.
You just mentioned all those things that's going on in society at the moment, the TV and the desires. Krishna is also saying in Bhagavad Gita that everybody is following his path. That we are always servants of Krishna. Either we have to try to serve Krishna under the internal energy or under its external. So all those things that go on, if I understand it in this way, it seems also to be the plan of Krishna, or to some extent.
Everything goes on under the eye of God. We can't do anything without his sanction. But he does give us a little independence, which we can use properly or misuse. When we misuse it, we are in the material world. So we can't escape Krishna, but he may give us a little room to act out our fantasies of being an enjoyer of this world. When Krishna says everyone is on my path, that doesn't mean that everyone's saintly. It just means that, like you said, either they're acting under spiritual direction or they're in material illusory consciousness. But it's all under Krishna. It's like serving time. That's interesting, yeah. That's more an English idiom, isn't it? That you're serving time. You couldn't say in Ireland, but in Britain you could say, I'm a guest of Her Majesty in Her Majesty's prison. I just spent the last 5 years as a guest of Her Majesty, but not in Buckingham Palace, in Wormwood Scrubs or something. So Yeah, serving time. Carlos me, Krishna says, I am time. So yeah, we're serving time in the material world. In the prison house of the material world. So, prasadam? Prasad? Little fruit for everyone. Okay. Hare Krishna. You have a little kirtan? Finish up with a lot. You want to sing again?